Welcome, everybody, to our Tuesday evening Bible study here at Granite Bay. We're glad that you've come out. And want to welcome our friends who are watching via the internet and Facebook from around the country and other parts of the planet, we understand. And we are going through the book of Genesis, and we're taking it very carefully. And I think we started even before the new year, but we're only on Genesis 10 tonight. And so I've got the dubious responsibility as we begin here to delve into some of the difficult names to pronounce. Maybe I should pray before we begin. Father in heaven, we just thank you for your presence, for the promise that if we seek for wisdom, you'll grant it. Help us to understand these very important foundational teachings that we see in this first book of books. And bless, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Now, where we left off the story, it talks about Noah surviving the flood and some of the circumstances that surrounded that. Now it begins to talk about the nations, the sons of Noah, and how they began to populate the planet and what happened after that, and gives some very important foundational information to understand the dispersing of the nations, principally there around the Middle East area, but subsequently the whole world. Verse 1, Genesis 10. And God willing, we're going to get through half of Genesis 11, talking about the Tower of Babel. Now, this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah. Just checking. Anyone here related to them?
Yes.
All of us, right? So this is relevant for you. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. And the sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog. Just got to pause. Does Magog appear somewhere else in the Bible? You get to Revelation, you have Gog and Magog. They represent the enemies of God's people through history, because way back here, the first time you find Magog mentioned, they ended up becoming, these are not the sons of Shem, you notice, they ended up becoming some of the adversaries of Israel. So later in history, in Revelation, Gog and Magog, that Magog means from the matrix or having come out of Gog. So it's like Babylon and her daughters. Gog and Magog, they're the wicked that are all resurrected there in Revelation chapter 20. Magog, Madian, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families. Now notice it mentions language before it mentions Babel. We've already learned that the Bible is often written where it tells some details, and then it goes back and tells what led to those details. You'll find God gives an overview of creation, then he backs up and he talks about Adam, noticing a wife was missing. And you'll see that happening in a minute. It'll talk about how the language is developed. But right now it's giving an overview of the genealogies. Question, yes?
So if we're not Jewish, we probably come from Japheth?
Your question is, if you're not Jewish, you probably come from Japheth? No, not necessarily. You could come from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Not every descendant of Shem is Jewish. But the Semites, you've heard of a Semite? If you're anti-Jewish, you're called anti-Semitic. If you're anti-Arab, you're anti-Semitic. Because all the descendants of Shem, that's where you get the word, the Semites. That meant Shemites. But not all of them were Jewish. You don't really get to the Jews until you get, well, Abraham was technically a Hebrew. And the word Hebrew means the ones that crossed over, or they came across the Euphrates. So it's a good question, though. Well, it tells us that the coastland, so some of these may have populated the ocean coasts around the Mediterranean at that time.
All of a sudden we got people all over the place. There's only 8 people.
Okay, question is, how do we go from 8 people to people all over the place? How long were people living before the flood? It's a good question. Thousands. Not thousands, but hundreds. Yeah, almost 1,000 years. And even after the flood, Noah lives 300 years more. Shem lives well over into the time of Abraham. He lives 500 years after the flood. And so you'll notice that, like Abraham's father, he lives 200 and something years. Terah, they were living a long time. So if you've got 100 years of fertility and God has told you to be fruitful and multiply, I saw some geneticists that did the math on this. There could have been hundreds of thousands of people in 200 years. You know what exponential growth is. How many children of Israel went to Egypt with Jacob? It numbers them. 70. 70. You go 200 years later, and there's, is it 600,000 fighting men? Yeah, that's just the fighting men, not counting women and children. But you know what it says, why they were in Egypt? It says they multiplied greatly. The Egyptians said, can you tell the midwives to stop birthing them babies? They're just having so many babies. And so Adam and Eve, rather Noah and his family, the vitality, very little disease, very little infant mortality, a lot of fertility. They're very healthy, live a long time. Wow, yeah. You start thinking about it. And yeah, your parents could still be having children when you already have grandchildren. Did you ever think of that? Yeah. So they multiplied very quickly. No, they probably waited. We know they waited a little later. People can't hear you. Let me repeat. The question is, they probably didn't have children as early as we do. No, they probably did not, because you read some of the patriarchs didn't even get married until 100.
They may not have had them.
But I think after the flood, their lives are shortened. The age of marriage goes down. It actually later in the genealogies tells them when they got married. But help me get through this, because we haven't gotten to Babel yet. And I got a lot to say about Babylon. Verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabat, Rama, Sabatka, and the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Cush begat Nimrod. So Nimrod is a great-grandson of Noah. And now it stops and it says something interesting about Nimrod we've got to develop. He became a mighty one. Now so far it said almost nothing about everybody else, but it stops at Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter. Now the word Nimrod almost means rebellion or against God. It says he was a mighty hunter, not before the Lord, but against the Lord. After the flood, look at how quickly people multiplied. What about the animals? They're all over the planet too, so they must have multiplied. And some of them, we've seen the fossils, the mammals that existed before the flood. Some were very large, from much larger than what we have today. There were probably mastodons and all kinds of things. Not all of them were friendly. There are some animals that are extinct today that probably were before the flood. They came off the ark, very large. And before the flood, God said he put the fear of man in the animals. But after the flood, I just read it again today, that was largely lost. And so people were afraid of some of these man-eaters and wild animals. So having someone like Nimrod that could help defend the people, he found his way into a position of leadership and fear of the wild beasts. You can trace the history of Israel. God said that when they came into the promised land, he said, I'm not going to have you drive out the Canaanites too quickly, or the beasts will fill the land. And maybe you remember that when the children of Israel were carried off to Assyria, the Assyrians sent some of their people down to the northern kingdom of Israel. It says the lions were eating them all, because it had been vacated so long that the animals just proliferated. And anyway, so Nimrod is a mighty hunter. Have you ever heard, there's a very ancient story that's got a lot of interesting biblical language. It's called the Epic of Gilgamesh, or the Gilgamesh Epic. Talks about a flood, talks about after the flood letting go a dove and letting go a raven, and after 7 days, I mean, a lot of very similar language. The gods were angry, you know, it says gods, and destroyed the wicked. And when they look at some of the characteristics of Gilgamesh, some of the ancient historians believe this is the same person as Nimrod. He was a kind of a brutal king, Gilgamesh. And his name in the cuneiform translation was very similar to rebel. So it tells us about Nimrod. It says the beginning, I'm in verse 10, Genesis 10:10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, that's going to be our study for tonight, is about Babylon. Babel in the Babylonian, or Chaldean means gate. And they talked about it like gate of God. What did Jacob say when he dreamed with a rock for his pillow and he saw this ladder going to heaven? He named it Bethel. He said, surely this is the gate of heaven. So he named the city as a gateway. They wanted to build a tower that would be a gateway to heaven. That comes up in the next chapter. So just make a note. Now, the Hebrew word for Babel later came to mean confusion. Some believe that the etymology is because it the confusion that the Tower of Babel. Why do you call a baby a baby? Babel. It's connected with the word Babel or Babel, because babies babble. They call it babies babbling, which goes back to the Tower of Babel also. Anyway, too much on the words. All right. And it says, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calne, in the land of Sinar. That's all in the area of Mesopotamia. They came from the mountains of Ararat. They migrated down between the Tigris and Euphrates, where ostensibly the Garden of Eden used to be, and they wondered if anything was left. And from the land he went to Assyria, and he built Nineveh, one of the most ancient cities in the world. So you got two cities that were enemies of God's people. Where did Jonah go preaching? Nineveh. And then Babylon. It's interesting, the Assyrians from the north, they came and they conquered the 10 tribes. And then you've got the Chaldeans, they came and they conquered the southern kingdom. So right here at the very beginning, you see the cities of Nineveh and Babel, which were adversaries of Jerusalem. And it's like history is written very early.
Pastor,
question.
Is Assyria the same country as Syria is now?
Yes, the word Syria is derived from ancient Assyria. Territory is not exactly the same. The borders aren't the same, I should say. But yeah, it's the same region. Some of these are very ancient countries. They were enemies of Israel way back. Now, you'll read in the Bible, and you'll read about Syria, and then you'll read about Assyria. They are two different places. Assyria, I think, is more inland. It was an inland empire. One had Damascus as the capital. The other had Nineveh, which both exist today. So I used to get them mixed up. I'd hear them say Syria and then in the Bible, and then they'd say Assyria. Well, they're two different kingdoms, both enemies, both kind of to the north, one northwest, one northeast. All right, moving along. And it says, where did I leave off here? And it says, okay, in the border, I'm in verse 19. No, let me see. Let me back up here. Verse 12. And reason between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. Merizim, he's back to the genealogies now, began Ludum, Ananim, Labayim, Naphtim, Pathrusim, and Calisium, from whom came the Philistines. Now, this is another thing that plays out later. The Philistines and the Kaphorim. Canaan begat Zidon, his firstborn, and Heth. Now you notice these places end up becoming cities. There's a land called Canaan. There's a city called Zidon. And Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, the Sinite, the Avardite, the Zemurite, the Hathmeite. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. So here you see the descendants of a lot of the people that inherited the land of Canaan later had to be expelled when the children of Israel came in. And the border of the Canaanites was from Zidon as you go towards Gerar, as far as Gaza. Then you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboam. These are the four cities that were later destroyed. As far as Lasha. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their language, in their lands and in their nations. And children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber. That's where you get the word Hebrew, the people who are from Eber. Shem is where you get the Semites. The brother of Japheth, the elder, the sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arphaxad begot Selah. Selah begot Eber. To Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan begat Almodad, Seliph, and Hazarmaroth, Jera, Hadoram, Uziel, Dekel, Obel, Adbenmel, Sheba, Ophir, you've heard of the gold of Ophir. Havilah, the gold in the land of Havilah was said to be beautiful. Jobab, all these were the sons of Joktan. And their dwelling place was from Mesha as you go towards Sefer and the mountains to the east. These were the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages. There you got languages again. In their lands according to their nations. These were the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations in their nations. And from these the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. Now notice that word, the nations were divided. Go back and I read something. I skipped over it just to see if I could get through the names. You notice it says in verse 25, to Eber was born two sons. The name one was Peleg. For in his day the earth was divided. And then again, this chapter ends by saying divided. Now it backs up and tells you how it was divided. Some people, they read the story about Peleg and they said, oh, that was in his days the continental drift took place and all the continents were formed through separation. But it's really talking about the languages were divided and the people then scattered from Babel and spread across the territories of the planet. So now it's going to back up and it's going to tell us this very interesting story about Babylon. Now the whole earth, and you're welcome to stop if you have questions. I won't promise I can answer them, but I'll do my best. Yeah, Terry?
All the way through this period of time, the earth as created existed.
Yeah, during the period of, we're reading about the period of time following the flood. So the earth is not like it was. This is all following the flood. So from chapter 9 on is after the flood. All right, so the whole earth had one language and one speech. And everyone wants to know, what was that one language? Was it German? I hope not. German sounds like a real guttural language. Sorry to my German friends out there. Spanish is a very pretty language. They're what they call the romantic languages. Karen and I were in New Guinea. Sorry, Karen's German, but I still think German is very guttural. We were in New Guinea, and they have 800 languages in that one land because they're all separated by very steep mountains and valleys, and they just stayed isolated. So you got all these different languages that develop over time. But what language will we speak in heaven?
English.
Yeah. How will we understand if they don't speak English? That's right. So how many of you speak more than one language?
We'll speak in tongues.
I see about half of you. You've heard before that if a person speaks three languages, they're called trilingual. If you speak two languages, you're called bilingual. And if you speak one language, you're called American. In most places I go through Europe, people speak multiple languages, and even South America. So it's... We'll speak Babylon. No, we're going to speak the language of Canaan. We don't know what that is. All right, let me read on here. So they journeyed from the east, and they found a plain in the land of Shinar. And there they dwelt. Now they've come down from the region of Ararat. They kind of go east. They're really going southeast. And they found a plain. This is later known as the area where Mesopotamia is. And they dwelt there. And back then, keep in mind, climate back then was not exactly the same now. We know, you go through northern Africa, and they find these petroglyphs up in the Sahara, and these people have carved antelope and crocodiles and hippopotamus, all these river creatures and grazing creatures, and it's sand now. So we've just observed in 200 years the spread of desertification, I think they call it. And so things are different. The climate then was much nicer. The land of Canaan, flowing with milk and honey, was a lot nicer than it is today. So they went, it was a beautiful farming. They could grow very quickly. They could supply a lot of food for people through farming. And it came to pass, they found the plain, and they said to one another, come, let us make brick, and let's bake them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. I had a friend who's an architect, and he said, it's amazing how high you can go in a building with block. That's just the incredible amount of weight that brick can support. And it tells us they had asphalt for the mortar. They didn't have concrete back then, but it makes pretty good. There's still some asphalt brick buildings they found that are thousands of years old in Mesopotamia. And, they have a lot of oil there, so they got what they call slime pits where you get the asphalt. Southern California, we call them the tar pits. And so they would make the asphalt for that. And let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. And come, let... Now, are they doing this to get closer to God? Or are they wanting to glorify God's name? They say, come, let us build ourselves that we may make a name for ourselves. So is the tower to glorify God, or is it to glorify man? So one thing you're going to notice about the Tower of Babel is it is at the foundation for man-made salvation. Now, what did God say about a flood? Did he say he was going to destroy the world with a flood again? No, he made a promise. They weren't so sure they trusted. They thought, you know, we're in a plain, if there's a big flood, we're surrounded by the Tigris and Euphrates, we'll run to the tower for salvation. And so it's like they didn't really believe. And the environment changed after the flood too. There may have been some kind of envelope around the world and polarized the rays of the sun. Everything was temperate all around the planet. Now they begin to worship the sun. And Babylon, the foundation of Babylon, was sun worship. Probably had an altar at the top. And they said, let's build this tower and make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the whole earth. Now, what had God told them to do right after the flood? After Garden of Eden and after the flood? He said, go forth, spread out, fill the earth, multiply, be fruitful.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that all of the pagan religions, even dating back hundreds of years, central to their worship is some kind of a tower or a pyramid.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The root of that is.
Pastor Ross is making a good point that you go around the world, you can go to the Far East and they got their towers. You can go to the America, Central America, and they got some incredible pyramids. The Egyptians have their pyramids. I mean, all over the planet, you see they build, and they're often square ziggurats, they're pyramid-shaped buildings that they find many places. Even in the Americas, the North American Native Indians would build earth pyramids that they found, some of the Plains Indians further back east.
Question. Through this period of time, these guys got all these crazy ideas. Where did they come from?
Where did the crazy ideas come from? Well, man has never had a shortage of imagination. And some of it probably is inspired by the devil. Some by God, we hope.
Yeah.
Man-made worship. All right, so they want to build this tower. I remember growing up in New York City. You know, the Empire State Building is one of the most amazing buildings. They have never matched the records of building the Empire State Building. At one point, for several years, it was the tallest building in the world, and I always kind of was enamored by it because I watched King Kong as a kid, the old black and white version, and we had this puppet on top of it. But it was, you know, I grew up looking at the Empire State Building. Karen and I lived at the base of the Empire State Building during Net 99. We'd look up at it every night from our apartment. And when they were building it, it was a masterpiece of architectural engineering and ingenuity. They kind of did it with prefab sections. It was completed in less than 2 years. Now, how can they do the Empire State Building in 2 years and we can't build a church in 20? There's something wrong with that.
Progress.
And they broke construction records that have never been past. Well, I think the Chinese actually have. It says one 14-floor section was erected in a week. 14 stories in a week. And they were very motivated. Now the tallest building in the world.
They didn't have as much regulation.
Yeah, they didn't have the California environmental laws back then. The tallest building in the world, I've been there, is the Burj Khalifa. They called it the Burj Dubai, but in the United Arab Emirates, and it's like 2,717 feet, and Saudi Arabia is, I understand they've got plans drawn, they've already started the foundation work to build a building that is almost a mile high, or maybe it's a kilometer, sorry, but it's just incredible. Now it makes you think, here we are near the end of time, they keep building the buildings bigger and bigger. So, let's read on here. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, these people are one, and they have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us. Now, here God is saying, let us. Why does God say, let us? Is God schizophrenic and he's talking to himself? Or does God have more than one person in the family? You've got Father, Son. It's like back in the beginning, he said, let us make men in our image. Now God said, and let us go down and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. Now, why did God say that if we don't stop them, nothing they attempt will be forbidden? Does God allow cause and effect to happen in the world he's created, or does he manipulate everything? Doesn't God give people freedom to do things right or wrong and experience the results? Aren't there some unbelievers that have worked very hard and built companies and seem to have some success? And you might say, why are they successful? Why is God making... They're successful because they work hard. God allows cause and effect to happen in the world. And here he's saying, I'm going to interrupt that because otherwise it's going to end poorly. It's going to be for their better interest if I stop this right now and force them to scatter. So, because they're going totally against what he said. I'm sure there were voices. Was Noah alive then? And Shem? Yeah. They were probably speaking against it and said, this is not the right plan. God told us to scatter, to multiply. And so it says, the Lord came down to see the city. Does that mean that God was unaware of the city until he came down to see it? It's like, you remember when Jesus, on his way to Sodom and Gomorrah with two angels, he stops to see Abraham. It says, the cry of the place has come up to me. Of course, you haven't gotten to that here yet in our study, but I'm sure you've all read it. It says, I'm going down to see whether the cry of it is as bad as what I've heard. It's like God got a postcard and he's going to check it out in person. The Lord knows everything. But sometimes before God visits a judgment, he personally, it's like he makes his final personal appeal to see, is it as bad as they say? And he knows all things. So the Lord came down to see the city. So it's not just the tower. What else are they building? A city. Who started the city? Nimrod, the mighty hunter against God, the rebel. He became one of the first kings. Up until Nimrod, can you name a king? He's the kind of the king of Babel, which is sort of synonymous with the devil, his Babylon against God. Come, let us go down and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building. All right, well, let's just pause here and talk about that. This is interesting when you read about this in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. There's some interesting quotes here. Evidently, while they're in the process of building, the tower is very tall. Some history says, who was it? Herodotus, the ancient Middle East historian. He was a Greek historian, actually. In 440 BC, he said that the Tower of Babel, you could still see the foundation back then, it was 660 feet in length and breadth. It was square, and it was the same height. And according to the Greek historian Strabo, it rose to the same altitude, making it over 200 feet higher than the Great Pyramid of Khufu. Now, some people think of the Tower of Babel, and we picture something like Jack and the Beanstalk's beanstalk that disappears up into the clouds. Now, they weren't really trying to get into outer space. It was just higher than anything man had built. And it wasn't until the Eiffel Tower that something was built higher, that a man-made structure. Did you know that? From the Tower of Babel. Higher than the great, 200 feet higher than the Great Pyramid of Khufu. It was also of a pyramidal form consisting of 8 square towers gradually descending in breadth. So it was like a ziggurat with 8 in breadth, with a widening ascent on the outside, so very broad as to allow horses and carriages to pass each other and even to turn. So you've got this spiral square that each level it goes up, it's got 8 levels that you look at. There's a road that goes around it that keeps getting spiraling closer in a vortex at the top so that people could travel this wide, it says wide enough for vehicles to not only pass but turn around with carriages. And so this is a massive man-made structure. And assuming all these historians are right, so very broad as to allow horses and carriages to pass each other and even to turn, the apex, of course, was an altar where sacrifices were offered to the sun god. The infamous monument to rebellion was later destroyed by the Persian king Xerxes. Later, when he was conquered by Alexander the Great, Alexander wanted to rebuild the tower. In fact, he had most of the debris removed preparatory to its reconstruction when he died. And so what happened after that is gradually, when there's a time of poverty and there's free building materials, a lot of the poor people just pry away the stones. A lot easier to take brick that's already baked. That's what happened to a lot of the Wall of China, is after the kingdom sort of imploded at different times in history, the people started taking the stones and saying, hey, I could use this. And they drag them off and build their homes and their farms and their walls with them, and certain the wall is gone in different places. Question, Mike.
Do we know, was the tower solid, or was it a habitation, commercial?
Question is, was the tower solid, or were there places that were inhabited? We don't know. I've heard both. I've heard that there were actually dwellings along the way. Somewhere else, I believe, reading, and I hesitate saying this if I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that I had read that they had priest quarters built into it, either at the base or along the way up. So it's such a massive building for it to just be solid like the pyramid. It's sort of a waste of space. But we don't know for sure. Some of this has been lost in history. So it's very tall, and they're passing materials up and down, and maybe through carriages or pulleys, and communication is very important in a big project like that. And so they send down a message, and they say, yeah, send up more asphalt. And all of a sudden, a bunch of sticks come up, and they go, no, we said asphalt. And they say, what? Oh, you want more brick? No, we said asphalt. And they can't understand each other. All of a sudden, they start speaking different languages. Now, I learned how to say, like, good evening, everyone, in several languages, because I'd go different parts of the world, and I'd always want to say a few words in some language. Now, if you go to Pohnpei, I would say Sotik Malkarusia, which is good evening, everyone. And if you go to India, of course, there's 100 languages in India, but in Tamil, it was Anivarakam Malivanakam. And that's very different from Sotik Malkarusia, or good evening, everybody, or buenas noches, amigos, or whatever you're saying. And so all of a sudden, they just could not understand. Have you tried to understand someone from Louisiana? And they're supposed to speak American. Question.
The Tanya tribe, God said, for them, I will install the people's pure language that they may all call on the name of the Lord to serve him with one accord. Is that prophecy for the future or the past?
All right, question about the prophecy about I'll call on them with one language, so they shall serve the Lord in one language of one accord. Yeah, I think that is a prophecy about the future, but I'm getting to that tonight if I have time. I think I can get to that tonight to answer that. So the Tower of Babel, they can't understand each other. This fell apart in confusion. I'm going to read from you Patriarchs and Prophets, page 120. The builders were wholly unable to account for the strange misunderstandings among them. And in their rage and disappointment, they reproached one another. Their confederacy, that was to make a name for themselves, ended in strife and bloodshed. Lightnings from heaven, as an evidence of God's displeasure, broke off the upper portion of the tower and cast it to the ground. Men were made to feel there is a God who rules in the heavens. So not only did they not understand each other, a God demonstrated with a terrible storm his displeasure, and lightning struck the tower and blew up a large portion of it. So from this cursed project, they all divided up, probably with families and different families and clans that could kind of understand each other, until they sort of refined their individual communications and the languages spread out. Now, we ended chapter 10, and it says, the nations were divided on the earth. And we read earlier that in the time of Peleg, the nations were divided. So after Babel, the nations began to divide. Now, the word Babylon is really a parallel opposite for Jerusalem. When you get to Revelation, you've got, of course, you've got the earthly Jerusalem, you've got the earthly Babylon. When you get to Revelation, you've got a spiritual Jerusalem. It's called the New Jerusalem. And you've got a spiritual Babylon. In fact, you can read where Peter, when Peter in chapter 5 of, is it 2 Peter? He talks about your elect sister. Here it is. It's 1 Peter chapter 5, 13. She who is in Babylon, elect together with you, greets you, and so does Mark, my son. Now, I should just mention, this is as far as I want to go tonight in reading. I would like to do a little more explaining. So we're stopping, for whoever teaches next, I'm stopping after verse 9. And then it goes back into the genealogies. Let's talk a little bit about Babylon. So Babylon, why is that an important city? Babylon got rebuilt even though it was a city that was cursed. Can you think of another cursed city in the Bible that wasn't supposed to be rebuilt, but it was rebuilt? God pronounced a curse on anyone who rebuilds Jericho. And during the time of Ahab, a man disregarded God. It was such a great location. He says, let's rebuild it. And he succeeded in rebuilding Jericho, but it cost him two of his sons, which is what the curse of Joshua said would happen, specifically. It said, you'll lay the foundation in your firstborn, and you'll set up the gates in your youngest. Mm-hmm. Or vice, I think that's what it said. And the last thing you do when you build the city is set up the gates. The first thing is you lay the foundation. So from start to finish, God's curse was upon Jericho. And you'll always find that it was like the closest thing to Sodom and Gomorrah, biblically. When it says someone's going from Jerusalem to Jericho, remember the man who fell among thieves? He's going from the city of God down to Jericho. And Jericho was often associated with bad things. But it was rebuilt. Babylon was cursed, but they rebuilt it. Do you remember when King Hezekiah was sick? And in those days, Merodach Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent messengers to Hezekiah because he heard he had been sick and he recovered. He wanted to inquire about the wonder when the sun stood still. So Babylon was a kingdom, even for years after the tower was destroyed. But later when Nebuchadnezzar came along, it reached its zenith. And you've got two kingdoms that reach unsurpassed zenith of gold. Jerusalem under Solomon, Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. They're both extremely wealthy. It says that silver was counted as nothing in Jerusalem during Solomon's reign. Why? Everything was gold. And how is Babylon identified during Nebuchadnezzar's reign? It's the golden head. Daniel said, you are the head of gold. It was a beautiful kingdom, the hanging gardens and the moats and double walls and lots of grain. So, interesting, Nebuchadnezzar reigned 40 years, Solomon reigned 40 years. And they're almost like opposites, they're polar opposites. Until you get to the last days where you've got God's people is called the New Jerusalem. It says the church that is above, the New Jerusalem, mother of us all. And then Babylon is the harlot, it's the counterfeit church that you find. And so you have these two at war. And God has people in Babylon. Just a couple of thoughts. Oh, I got so much I could share. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. They're the patriarchs. Abraham takes Sarah, his wife, out of Mesopotamia, Babylon, brings her into the promised land. When it comes time for Isaac to get married, Abraham says, don't get a girl from here, but go get one from Mesopotamia. Eliezer goes and he gets Rebekah, brings her out of Mesopotamia into the promised land. Where's Jacob get his wife? Goes back, gets his wife out of Babylon, brings her out of Babylon to the promised land. What does Jesus want to do for us? Takes out of Babylon to the promised land. Were God's people once captive in Babylon? And God saved them. Cyrus gave them permission. He brought the remnant out of Babylon into the promised land. Ezra, Nehemiah during that time. In the last days, does God say, Babylon is fallen. And he calls his people to come out of Babylon into the promised land. And so you kind of see that what really happened in history here with Babylon is an allegory for so many things later in the Bible. For one thing, Babylon sort of becomes a monument to salvation by works. We don't earn it. You cannot climb to heaven. How did Jacob see you get to heaven? A ladder, that's Jesus. It's like the cross is the ladder to heaven. The tower is a monument to human pride. They said, let us make a name for ourselves. Are we living for our name or his name? It's a monument to man's defiance of God's will. God said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, scatter. They said, no, we're going to congregate right here. We're going to not do what you said. By the way, do Christians sometimes make the mistake of clustering when he tells us to spread?
Yes.
Yeah, he wants us to take our light and spread it around the world. Go and teach all nations. Ellen White says over and over to God's people, don't just all cluster together in Christian ghettos.
Enclaves.
Yeah, enclaves. That we can go out and spread. I think it's important for a healthy church to be sending out missionaries. Encourage people to think of the bigger picture. It's a monument to human achievement. They were so proud of their technology and that's why I think we must be living in the last days when men are going to build a tower a kilometer tall. How many feet in a kilometer?
I don't know.
Someone's going to look that up for me and tell me. I'm an American. Don't ask me that. It was a monument to disbelief in God's word. God had said, I will not destroy the world with a flood. And they didn't believe it. They're going to save themselves. And it's a monument to man-made heaven. You know, we're going to make heaven here on earth. So everything about the tower is sort of a challenge. Now you go to Revelation 17, and you find the word Babylon there. During the time of Peter, I told you, 1 Peter, he said, your elect sister in Babylon greets you. And that's verse 13 of chapter 5, 1 Peter. Was Peter talking about literal Babylon? There was nothing much happening in Babylon. They started referring to Rome as Babylon even during this time. Now, if you look in Revelation 17, you'll see that the name appears. Do you know the name Babylon is like 300 times in the Bible? That's a lot for a name in the Bible. Go to Revelation 17. It says, I was taken off in vision, and I saw this woman. I'm in verse 3. Carried me away in the spirit in the wilderness. I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs. I think most of you know that almost all of the Protestant reformers identified the church in Rome as Babylon. And they said, for the same reasons, man-made religion, pride, defiance of God's word, salvation by works, and the same things you see happening there in ancient Babylon, and even a confusion of tongues. The services were often given in a language the people did not understand. You ever heard the expression hocus pocus? You know where hocus pocus comes from? It's a phrase very similar to what they said in Latin, corpus pocus or something, but where the priest is pronouncing in Latin the body and the blood of Christ. And he claimed to be able to transform it into the real body and blood of Jesus. And so that's where they got the word hocus pocus. And a lot of the services and chants were in Latin. People didn't understand. But beyond that, is there babbling going on in Christian churches today?
Yes.
Yeah. What was the chief characteristic of Babylon? It was a confusion of tongues. How can someone say that the outpouring of God's Spirit is more confusion of tongues? At Pentecost, God actually reverses the curse of Babylon, and suddenly they understood what the disciples were saying in their own languages. So God has taken away the confusion so that they would understand the gospel. What did Jesus say in Mark 16? You will speak with other tongues. Where before they couldn't understand other tongues, he now gives them the ability to understand each other's speech. And so at Pentecost, the Galilean fishermen, the apostles, they couldn't speak all these different languages that had come to worship at Jerusalem. There used to be a lot of struggling with interpretation during these international feasts where pilgrims came from around the Roman Empire. But at Pentecost, when all those people were there, all the Jews from all these other countries that spoke other languages, suddenly they hear the disciples given a supernatural ability to understand their languages and preach in their tongues. So at Pentecost, God reverses the curse of Babel. Now that goes back to your question. It happened where they understood they were of one language in the gospel during Pentecost, but in heaven, when we get our glorified bodies, are we going to need translators to talk to our angels and each other? Yeah. Are all of a sudden, we supernaturally, are we going to be able to understand each other again? Yeah. Have you ever wondered when angels came down, like when the angel spoke to Mary, what language did he speak? He probably spoke Aramaic, right? And when the angel spoke to Noah, he spoke to him in whatever language the language of Canaan was, or the language of Eden was back then. And so we can see here in this whole story of the Tower of Babel, you've got it here, we just read Genesis, and now I jump to Revelation, and you see the theme of these kingdoms at war, two kinds of religion, the true gospel of Jesus, our high priest, Melchizedek, compared with Babylon and her daughters. It's the false religions that you find. And so there it were. Now, after the children of Israel were in Babylon for 70 years, when Nebuchadnezzar conquered the city, and nobody, other than the Romans, and I'm getting ahead of myself again, nobody really devastated Jerusalem quite as much as Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar went in and burnt the whole city. He burnt the gates. He knocked down the walls. He burnt the temple. He burnt the palaces. He just scorched it. That's why Nehemiah was crying to the king. He said, when I've heard about the condition of the city, he said, how can I be sad? The next time it happens is with spiritual Babylon, which was Rome. He has said, how can I be happy? Spiritual Babylon, Rome, they come in 70 AD. They do the same thing. They burn the temple. They burn the palaces. They knock over the walls. Not one stone is left upon another. And so you can see that Rome sort of repeats the history of Nebuchadnezzar. And once again, the people are scattered. But back to Nebuchadnezzar's time, and this will be my last thought. People of Israel are in Babylon for 70 years. Now, if you go somewhere for 70 years, and Nehemiah said how long they'd be there. Jeremiah said how long they'd be there. Daniel was reading the prophecies of Jeremiah. And that's when he had his vision in Daniel chapter 9. How comfortable would you be? Would you go ahead and buy a house if you're going to be somewhere 70 years? And your kids would get married. Would you learn the local language if you were somewhere 70 years? If your kids are growing up in Babylon, do you think they spoke Hebrew better or Babylonian? So when they're just surrounded with it, they get comfortable. They get two or three generations. And God said, you better get comfortable. You're going to be there a while. Finally, he says, okay, Babylon has fallen. Nebuchadnezzar died. His son, Belshazzar, is destroyed. Handwriting on the wall. Cyrus comes into power and says, they can go home now. You can go back to your land. How do you think a lot of the Jews responded? It's not that bad here. We kind of like city living. And we've gotten comfortable. And we've got friends here. We speak the language. We like having, Kmart is right around the corner. And the conveniences. And there was only a few that said, we want to go. God says to go, we want to go. And they were willing to forsake everything and leave. What made Abraham so great? Abraham was willing to leave everything and go until God told him to go. Later, the faithful like Ezra and Nehemiah, they were willing to leave at great sacrifice. God blessed them when they got there, but they had struggles. But they were going on a journey to the promised land. Now you get to Revelation. God says, Babylon is fallen. Come out of her, my people. Now what does that mean? All the counterfeit religions of the world, they're fallen. God says, come out of her. But we're so comfortable. We don't want to come out. It takes a real sacrifice. It's like when Eliezer says to Rebecca's parents, will a girl come with me to a land she's never seen and marry a guy she has no photographs? And she said, I will go. Boy, that takes courage. You know the story of Rebecca? He says, my master's got a rich son. He's got this beautiful promised land. Is she willing to leave everything and go? And they said, well, let's ask the damsel. I mean, you couldn't see what Isaac looked like. All you had is these, you know, guys you've never met until 2 days ago. Their word on it. He's got a lot of camels, that you know. But, I mean, and she says, we'll go. So it takes faith to come out of Babylon, doesn't it? And here we are now living in the last days. And if you come out of some of these churches where they got the babbling and the false teachings, the false doctrines, that's the wine of Babylon, to come into the promised land, it takes faith. And not everybody's willing to do it. But if you don't come out, what happens? That you receive not of her plagues. Those that stay in Babylon, it's not going to go well. And when Babylon falls, all those who stay in Babylon, you read about that in Revelation 18. Anyway, we got all the way from Genesis 10 to Revelation, so we're done studying the Bible now. I want to thank those who've been joining us. We'll continue with Genesis 11, verse 10, in our next study. God bless you.